Okay. Oh my goodness. Oh, good. There it is. WestLAMensGroup.com. How do you like my little gift of sobriety? I just got that at the front, so I went back there and put it on because I was like, well, it's obviously meant to be, so you got to put it on. Again, normally, if I got that, I would just not put it on because I wouldn't be open-minded enough. I'd be like, oh, that's nice. But I'm under new orders, like hand-delivered. Like, oh, no, I don't want the gift. So synchronicity, one of the things Luther gave me in the last month was a parable. I'm not going to go through the parable, but the end of the parable really was the lesson. How many beautiful, free gifts have come my way that I never accepted and opened up? It was a little thing about going to heaven. They open up a door and you look and there's all these really gorgeous wrapped gifts. The thing's full. And you're like, what, wow, what's this room? You know, this is cool. I'm dead. I can go do this. It's like, oh, that's all the gifts I sent your way that you didn't take while you were down there. So it's funny. So I got a gift. So I was like, put it on the gift, man. I'm going to unwrap them. Again, another good good lesson, you know. So how many gifts do we get, and out of our thinking, we just go, oh, no, not me. I'm good. That's a good inventory, too. My number one gifts that people send my way all the time that I don't unwrap is thank you, appreciation. Like I feel awkward just inside, you know, so I don't accept the gift instead of, and I've been taught it, so that would go on my list of things I'm not doing, you know, just, Rick, look him in the eye, open your heart, say thank you. Instead of that whole like, oh, I'm good. It's all good. It's all about you. And that wasn't the point. They already know that. They're just saying thank you. So we did a little love. And I don't know. I'm so conflicted. So I could just do my story. All right. We'll just do the story. All right. I'll just do the story. Yeah. Okay, so before we do the story, this is for all the people who want the story. Dear God, please let me set aside everything I think I know about you, about me, about the program, and about these steps, including Rick's story. For an open mind and a new experience of you, of me, of the program, and the steps, and Rick's stories. Amen. So I just put that in, you know, because, you know, a lot of people want to hear my story, but there might be a part of the story that's really moving, but I might not say it because it's a story. I just might not remember it. And if you're waiting for that because in another time I talked that was so special and doesn't come, you won't hear the rest of the story and you won't get that because I don't know what you're looking for, right? And I'm not the man I was last time you heard me talk. I'm a different man because you said to practice every day. So I'm very different. And I haven't talked out here in a long time, and some people have my CDs, and that's even longer. So I'm just not that guy if I'm doing what you tell me to do. Okay? So my first lesson learned in my story after 38 years here is everything I thought was true about my story and valid when I first came here outside of I'm powerless over alcohol and my life's unmanageable around that, I found out not to be true. Uncovered, discovered, discovered. My opinions, how I got hurt, my resentments, my story, you know? They just dismantled my story. That I was like, oh, my dad really wasn't that way. Oh, my childhood really wasn't that way. Oh, none of it was that way. So that's pretty wild. And I was thinking about that, prepping for this around my story. Like, well, what's true? And I said, wow, none of that's really true. It was all like old, like, you know, something occurs. I make an opinion about it, and I live in that opinion. You don't love me, or you're against me. You know, I'm just making the opinion, but it wasn't really true. So through this process, I've dropped a lot of that. The other thing when I first came here that was sad, but at the time I was very proud of it, was the only self-esteem I had was kind of like how tragic my story was, drinking. You know, that, like, I'm a really low-bottom drunk. That's the best I could do for my achievement list, because I had drank in all its forms, away everything else, including my dignity and everything. And you got to remember, I came here right before my 21st birthday, so many things just in the span of life I had not even come up to in my life. I had not experienced some of that. So I want you to kind of know that. So, you know, outside of a few things, drinking, what I have a tendency to do is not really talk about anything from my childhood. A lot of people say, I grew up here, I grew up there, for people to identify. But I just really would like you to identify to this piece here, which is what we have in common, is how do I know I belong, right? How do I know what's powerless about me? And what's unmanageable from my drinking, because we have that in common. So I'll say a little bit about that, because that's what matters, and how I knew I belonged here, which was I drank, you know, pretty young. You know, I came out of, I don't know how to describe it. I came out of a super loving family that was very cool, but I perceived physical threats to me very young in my environment, that I made a decision when I was young that the only way to survive that was that people really knew that I became what they were, which is, oh, I have to really become the most heartless, fearful person to deal with in your life, and you will leave me alone and I'll be safe. And I was the exact opposite. I was a super magical, loving, effeminate kid, like artist type, flowy. Maybe people might even thought, well, you know, if they were into it at that time, like, or thought about it, like, he might be gay. You know, like, really effeminate, a lot of feminine energy in me. And that was not rewarded where I came from in Ohio and Indiana. What was rewarded in my immediate family was high athletic ability and kind of be a man, that type of thing. So, and I got beat up around it a lot. Like, you know, pretty good. Enough to change my thinking that being this way is not okay, and I must be this other way. And I remember this thing they call the break from being. I remember the day I said to myself, I'm going to have to put this away, and I'm going to have to go be this other thing if I'm going to be okay here. In inventory, you get to the bottom, you kind of have that one moment that you just go another way. So I did that bit by bit. The problem about not being authentic for me was a rage started to boil in me. Slowly at first, but it grew quite large, and people started to see it. And I was a good football player. That's why I was, I was extremely violent. So, especially in high school, it stood out on the field. My dad, when he moved from Indianapolis to Cincinnati, picked a parochial school that was ranked in the top 10 in the nation because, you know, that's what you do where I come from. So it was a kind of a powerhouse, and I stood out in that powerhouse for my ability to rage violence between the lines. And again, I used that technique later, which I told you before, is could I do something that violence was okay so I wouldn't go to jail? And I realized that violence within that sport allowed me, even though off the field, by the time I was a senior in high school, I was very violent. And I had already lost control. So I tried to disguise myself as a heavy drinker, but I always had loss of control. And I was trying to just pass for a heavy drinker like my heavy drinker buddies. But I was already blacking out. And just once I took that, it was on, I didn't know if I'd stop or what would happen, or I had a lot of loss of control. So, but it did, the payoff in it was I did get some relief by being loaded. It just stopped my mind. Like, that's what worked, is it just stopped my thinking and numbed my pain. And can you relate? That's what we all do, I think. That's kind of our common denominator. The external thing I'm talking about is, maybe different in us, because some of us maybe never left our living room, but we're still blotting it out, and we're using something to do that, and that's what I did. And there was a part of me that was just so resentful at how people treated me. I just wanted everybody to pay. I really did. I really was indiscriminate about who would pay for it. I didn't know it at the time. And so, I would drink before school, which was a little abnormal. I'd drink before school just to get through school. And my grades were falling. I wasn't going to stay eligible because I just was drunk. And people, I don't think they knew that because of my persona, they knew I was crazy. So they didn't think I was drunk. They just thought I was crazy. I could just see teachers like, man, I can't wait till that guy graduates. He's great on Friday night and stadium's full, but I really need him to go, He's just unpredictable. So you kind of get how I was. And I spent, a significant amount of time in high school in jail for violence. like local jail, you know, like I'm down in the street, high schools are fighting each other, and I'm the first one to be in all that, all the time. And I'd get arrested, and they put me in jail, my dad would have to get me, you know, that's how it always was, you know, my family was getting very worn out, because they were just, everybody was scared, very scared. So, I would lose girlfriends who really liked me, but they were like, they would tell me I have to stop drinking, or in all its forms, and then they'd find forms of in my pocket, and they'd be like, I thought you were gonna give all that up. And they'd be crushed. I mean, I just remember the face. I'll never forget the face on this one woman. She just really cared for me, and she just knew she couldn't be with me because I was so out of control. You know, as a teenager, it's kind of trippy. So that's kind of the flavor of me. And and then to make a little extra money, I kind of went out of the high school thing, and because I was drinking heavily, and me and a couple guys who were a little crazier, I'd go downtown and enter bare knuckle fights, and make some money, and just get a willing participant to see who's going to pay. And they're all in their 20s and 30s, and I'm 17. And it got around really quick, like whoever that young guy is, you just really don't want to get in there because he really doesn't care if you kill him, because he's going to kill you. And I never put a hand on a human being without the intent to really hurt him or kill him, just how I was. It's a long journey. People who know me now, when they hear that story, they go, I can't even believe it. When people who know me now go back to where I came from, and they meet people from that era, they all say the same thing. It's like, man, I thought you were murdered years ago. I didn't know you were alive. Because it was just inevitable. Because of how I behaved. So I was just trying to rage against the machine. That was me, and it was all pain and messed up and wrecking cars. It's just horrible. And I had my real first serious thing with the law, you know. There was a bouncer at a party, and he had a reputation, he was pretty good at what he did, and he was just at the wrong party. And I just busted him down to the core, broke his face in, his jaw, broke all his ribs, broke his fingers, tore out his elbow, I just destroyed him, bit his ear off. It was horrible. I thought I killed him. A buddy of mine went back after he took him, like, is he dead? I remember that sinking feeling, like, oh my God. My rage is so, I would just black out in this rage, and I'd wake up afterwards, and people would look a certain way. I just was so out there. So of course, I really, went in front of the judge for that. And people were not pleased. And I really believe, probably my dad's diligence to not have my life ruined, and his resources, maybe. And frankly, I was a really great football player in a football town on its way to maybe be number one in the nation. And even probably that judge was not going to get in the way of that. So I didn't go to juvie. I got a long list of shit to do, but I did not go to jail, and I really should have. So I probably was enabled. That really led to even worse things. That's probably about as good as it got, and it got worse from there. So, you know, when we get to here, the shame, you know, like sobering up and the shame of all that, let alone all the other things I did, like just stealing, and I didn't know how to deal with the shame here. It was very hard for me. Like waking up and go, you know, I'm an animal. Like, I don't even know if I'm a human being. I'm like something else. I'm like a wild dog or something. But I knew I was good inside, but I just wasn't it. And I hadn't, you know, so. Like the flame out, you know. So I got a college scholarship to major Division I schools. I chose to go to Division II school because, of course, they paid me under the table. That's how I roll. And I was afraid, I'm short, so even though I'm super violent, you can get away with that in high school, but Division I, they're all big and violent. And there's a lot of people around the country just as angry as me. And they're raging against the machine between those lines, and I knew that. And I just knew that I probably wouldn't start, and I wanted to because I was just too small. So, and I was drunk, and I needed the money for my habits. So I took that scholarship. And, you know, you go before school, and the very first week of actual school, I was in the dean's office because I was in a blackout and went with two guys to the fraternity next to us, and like we harassed all the people in it, like terrified them, took all their furniture out of the bottom floor, put it on the lawn and burned it. They didn't really like that bonfire. It really didn't go over well. This was bad news. And I was like that every night. I couldn't even go to school, you know. I couldn't even make a class. I was just so drunk. And hurt my back, so I was kind of sidelined. And so long story short, I basically just drank that scholarship away. I left. And I didn't know what to do. And I came home, and a guy who was working at a bar said, "Hey, man, why don't you bounce in the bars with us?" And then they said, "We got a little side thing going. It'll be good." And I thought, that's perfect for my unmanageability with my rage, because if I did that, I probably wouldn't go to jail. So I took that job, and many of them like that, and because of it. Because I didn't want to go to prison, because I'm unmanageable. So, and I just remember, like, even then, like, saying I can't drink tonight. Like, I just can't do it. You know, like I'm getting wrecked because I'm putting so much in me. And I just, like, tonight I'm not going to drink. I just should not drink, you know. And then I'm powerless over alcohol, man, and I'm drinking. I mean, it's by 8 o'clock, you know. I mean, the crowd's not even there till 10. At 8, I'm drinking. And by 10, you know, I'm throwing you out. And if I, you know, I love dealers who come to big clubs because then I take all their cash and all their thing, and then I'm the dealer. So everybody knows where to go. And that's how I was like, you know, and just, I did not go to jail because they were like, he's enforcing the rules. So it really didn't matter what shape people were in when I was done with them. So I don't spend a lot of time on that. I think even you know, other people talk. I don't spend a lot of time on it, but I guess we're talking about love. And it's funny. It shows up like that, but all the rage is I just really wanted to be loved, and I didn't get it. I got the opposite, and I was just like, well, then I'll give it all to you back tenfold. And fuck everybody. I'll burn the whole place. That's kind of how I was. I'll just burn the whole place down then. If you're going to treat me this way, I'll treat you this that way. And we'll just see who lands. And by the end, I was so miserable, I just got more dangerous and dangerous things because I really wanted, you know, it was like suicide by homicide. I just really wanted someone to put me down. That's really the truth. And I couldn't say that. It took me a long time in AA to come to that truth that I was suicidal at the end of my drinking. I just hid it, but I was highly suicidal. And I had nothing. I had nothing. My family wasn't talking to me anymore. I'm in places I shouldn't be. For more money, I'm starting to work for, you know, these guys. Collecting debts, that's what I did. Because people didn't pay their either loan shark bill or their drug bill. I was one of the guys who knocked on your door and made sure you paid and to send a message, hence my trepidation and my amend later, since it was very clear that messages are very important to keep everybody in line. So, in December of 1980, I went on a binge. I think that's enough all that. You kind of get like my pain, and we don't need to go through all the stuff. It doesn't matter. I started drinking, and my blackouts got bigger and bigger. And I just remember, I know I started drinking in the club in Cincinnati a little before Christmas. I know Christmas hadn't happened. I just knew that. And I woke up, and I had a van, a customized van. Remember that in the day? It's all, I used to sleep in that van. And then I had a false kind of wall in that van, and behind the wall was, you know, guns, all types of stuff. It's just, you know, the things you need when you're angry and scared. Angry and scared, you have to do certain things. So that's what I had. So then I woke up on January 28th, 1981, my sobriety date, in my van, and it was very warm out. I was like, wow. Which happened a lot. Where am I? But it didn't feel like I'm in my vicinity. I started, and I thought like, oh, I wonder if it's like Christmas or, it was. I got out, and I was by a beach. And I was like, you know, you feel that panic of loss of control, like, oh my God, where am I? And I went to one of those little newspaper stand, you know, I still had those, and I looked in there, and it said January 28th, 1981, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And that's where I was. Like a month later. And I didn't remember any of it. I just had this foggy memory of before Christmas. And now, you know, through the years, I remember kind of pit stops, but very foggy. I don't know, and here's what was interesting. I said to myself at that moment, it was the morning, I said, okay, I'll wait in the van. I don't have anything. I don't have any guns. I don't have any. I'm like, I don't know what happened to me. So I said, I'll wait till that night because I'm by the Fort Lauderdale Strip, and I'll go out, and I'll just start rolling people, get another, you know, wad, and start over, you know. And then I thought, I better not go back to Cincinnati. I'll just start down here again. What I was doing. That was my intention. So I went into the van. I'm in the back of the van. It has a little skylight there, which became very important later. And I had a moment of clarity. And all that shame hit me. Like, it's almost like this whole life review of all my drinking and all the havoc started playing, and I just emotionally collapsed in there. I just collapsed. Just it all, the denial all went away, and it crushed me inside of that. And I did not get out of that van except late at night to pee. So when I started in that, I was in great shape, you know, because I was an athlete and I worked out, and I was about, I don't know, 270 pounds with a 32-inch waist. So I was like a brick house. A brick house. I got that. I'm still at zero, right, so far in this story? Okay. Brick. Oh, did I say a word? Got one already. Okay. Sorry. God. You know, when you're there, I'm feeling that right now. You see that? God. You know, like, I'm unmanageable. Like right there, you know, it's like, God, unmanageable. Now what do I do? Please help me. You know, same thing. Okay. And I just started like drinking water out of this house, like a hose, and I just didn't get out. I just didn't leave it. I didn't know what to do, and I just stayed in there, and I was kind of, I stayed in there to March. Long time. They wouldn't even let you park like that now. And at the end, I was looking up through the window, and I saw this star. And I just knew, like, if I didn't get help, I'd die in that. I knew I was dying. And I just saw this star, bright star through the thing, and I got this intuitive thought that I didn't never had. It said, just call home and ask for help. So I got out, went to a payphone, called Collect. And my mom answered. She got my dad on right away. And they just asked where I was. My brother flew down, and my dad and my younger brother drove down from Ohio. And I just remember the next day, my older brother, the oldest brother, Bob, opened the van and he puked because it smelled so bad. And when I went to the hospital, I was 133 pounds. And I was like green and my eyes were, you know, I was just in bad shape. And he just lost it. And it was so funny about love. He lost it. And he just, you know, just took the vomit off his face and dove it and grabbed it and hugged me and started crying. And he just started saying, I got you. You're going to be okay. I was not pleasant to my older brother, Bob, when I got bigger than him. But it didn't matter to him. And I knew that, and it felt really good, that love. You know? So, went to this hotel, which was really, they didn't want to let me in because I looked so bad. And my brother Bob, who's probably 24 years old, you know? He just tells them, I don't care what you think, you give me a room. Like, he doesn't confront anybody about anything. And they just kind of got startled, like, and gave him the room. He just was like, he's staying here. You don't have the right to tell him he can't just because he looks horrible. I guess he had a point, you know? Like, you can't discriminate about horrible, ugly-looking, dying people. So anyway, we were in there, and he was waiting for my dad to come to make a decision, but he was very scared, so he was thinking, should I just take him to the hospital? And I said, I'm good, I'm good. But he didn't really know, but he waited, and then my dad showed up. Now, my dad, I had a whole story about when we got here. We were arch enemies, just because he was the one trying to get me under control. So I'll just leave it at that. But we did not have a good relationship, according to me. And so anyway, my dad came in and he did the same thing. He started bawling. I've never seen my dad cry ever over anything. And he's been through some crazy stuff. And he just started crying. He just said, I got my boy back. He called me a boy. Because, you know, and I lost my childhood and boyhood a long time ago. I never considered myself a boy. I never knew how young I was. I felt so old. I felt like I was 50. I just was so worn on my road. And he called me a boy, and it kind of startled me, you know, like I got him. And I remember him calling my mom. He said, we're going to take you to the hospital, and calling my mom. And I heard him, he was in the, they had the room next door too, but I heard him through that. And my mom asked, how is he? And he just said, I don't want to lie to you, but I really don't think he's going to make it. He looks horrible. So they took me to the hospital, and the doctors told him that first day, they said, he won't make it. He's totally shut down. He's just going to die before we can get him together. Grace. I mean, I don't know. I don't know why I walked out of there, but I did. I didn't do anything. It just came back. Just came back. So that's how I almost got here. So then we had to talk. So my parents, because I was gone so long, thought someone murdered me because of who I worked for, because I'm uncontrollable. And they thought, he's such a drunk, maybe he's too loose-lipped, and they murdered him. Because he's just too out of control. And they probably had to put him down. That's what was the theory. So they were kind of dealing with that. And at that time, my mom's the most spiritual person I know. Way beyond anything I've achieved, like in practice. So when I got home, she was like, I always knew you'd come back. I said, why? And she said, because I went to church every day and prayed for you. No one else was praying for me. They were relieved I was not around. But my mother saw beyond all that and knew it wasn't me. And she prayed for me. Her novenas. And she goes, I just knew, because she had a conscious contact, it wasn't hope. She goes, I just knew it was going to be okay. She did that every day. For hours, my dad said, like, she'd go to 6 a.m. and come back like 9 a.m. and just sit in there, do her thing. It's a pretty good example. So now I'm doing the same thing. Just sitting in there doing my thing. So my dad asked, like, could I even come back? Like, they didn't really want the thunder to come down on them because they were like, they didn't know what I was into. So I just said, well, I think you're okay, but I really don't know. I don't think anybody would. But it was a big concern for my father, like the safety of the family, if he even brought me back home. And they discussed maybe I should go somewhere else. In the end, because of my mother, they brought me back home because my mother said, you bring him to me. So my dad was obedient to his wife. I understand that now, being obedient to my wife, no matter what I think about certain things, if it matters more to her, I'll just do it. It's all good, you know. And when I got there, they had talked to a priest while I was gone, and they said, look, he's an alcoholic. And if he ever comes back, you should send him to treatment or AA. So my parents had my college money because I got a scholarship. So they said this to me. It's like, we're not giving you your college money. We're either going to keep it or we'll pay for treatment for you. And I went to treatment. And I was by far the youngest person in the place. But that's how I got introduced to this program. So, and like, I felt relieved, but the problem I had coming in here was this shame. Like, I didn't know, and I really wasn't. I got a sponsor, I learned a lot, but I just wasn't doing what you guys said to do. I was going to meetings, I was doing all that, but I just wasn't doing it. And a very long story short, a guy who owned a really large club in Cincinnati, someone defaulted. He's the guy who built it. He knew nothing about it, and it was very she-she. And he needed coolers. Coolers are people who come in for a higher price to come and clean out drug dealers and all that. And that's what I was. I traveled from bar to bar as a cooler, but I was worse than them. But the attendants go, once all the women leave, the men leave, and you lose all your profits. So you got to make sure it's good. So that's why I did. And, so anyway, he asked me, and I told him no, that, I'm sober, I'm not going to do it. And so he asked me to come downstairs. I was in this building downtown. And down on the stairs was a wagon, a station wagon, with his wife and 7 children. He said, if I don't turn that place around and get my money out of it, my family's going to lose everything. I'm going to go bankrupt, and I won't be able to feed my children. I'd love for you to reconsider. So I told my sponsor all that, and he said, don't do it anyway. He said, you just can't go anywhere near that type of lifestyle. And I felt so bad, and, typical rookie mistake. I took it because I thought, this would be a good amend to get on the right side of the law and do something good in an area I was not good at. So I took it. And there was another cooler that was known in the Midwest. He was this really cool Special Forces cat, straight as an arrow. He hated me, because I was everything he wasn't, and I was just no good. So I decided to ask him if he'd work with me, because the gig was way too big. So I went to him, and he let me have it about what he thought of me. And I told him I've been sober for, I wasn't even 6 months sober. And I told him about this guy. He went and met him, and he came back to me. I don't think it was because of me. I think it was because of him. He said, I'll do the gig with you, but we're going to do it my way. So I did that. But what happened in that was I started missing my meetings, because I was at night. I'm doing all this gigging, and I'm sleeping later, and it's slipping. And I'm not drinking, but I'm getting drier and drier. And people in the program are coming down to the clubs begging me to come to a meeting. Oh, yeah, I didn't do it. And I'd hit one once in a while. Like, if I located myself, I was just hanging out with people in AA. I wasn't in AA. I'm hanging out with people in AA. You might think I'm in AA, but I'm not in AA. I'm hanging out with them. So you want to ask yourself that question. Am I just hanging out with people in AA, or am I in AA? And I was hanging out. And I just got very mentally ill. And I wasn't as violent as I was, but I was highly trained. So in those situations, I still was extremely effective, and I was a very good teacher, and we did it all his way, and we really created something unique that God was very successful, which actually made me feel good. I felt like, God, at least I'm not a criminal. I really did feel good, and I did not know how sick I was getting. I thought I was getting better, but I wasn't. And at the same time, I was doing inventory, and I went to my fifth step, and I left off the biggest thing of my inventory. And I remember when I was in the penitentiary, a couple years after that, I knew it was directly related to that. And then you guys had told me, man, put everything on there. That take to the grave list, get it on there. And the thing I didn't put on there is, you know, am I gay or not? I didn't put it on. Because that was my deepest wound. You're like, because I was effeminate, you know, they hurt me. And I just didn't want to reveal that. I didn't want to be that vulnerable and go in there. And I just didn't want to do it. Like, I'm 21. I just didn't do it. And I knew it. I knew leaving it, going to review when you go back home for an hour, I'm reviewing and feeling horrible because I didn't do it. I got better anyway, you know what, for a week because I dumped so much, you know, but I was not together. So long story short, that's a low point. I think you were asking for low points in sobriety. That was a low point. Even though a lot of my life got together because I just wasn't around wreaking havoc everywhere. And I was kinder. You know, I don't want to be so hard on me. People would say, God, you're the new guy, you know, in a lot of ways. But hindsight, 38 years later, it's a different story, you know. So anyway, the place we had, there was a hotel attached to it with a private elevator because it was disco and rock and roll. And we were a full block underground. It held about 3,000 customers. So any gig that came through town, they stayed in that hotel and the VIPs would come and sit in there. So all the entertainers and everybody came, they would sit in there. And one day someone said to me and my partner, hey, someone's checking out the security flow. Which is really not a good thing. It means, one, they're very sophisticated. And two, it's like, are they going to hold you up? For me, you check that out in case are you going to murder somebody? So we were very worried. So after observing him for a few minutes, and he really was doing that, and very good, Russell and I said, what are we going to do? And Russell made the call. In his special forces way, he just said this, because they're very nonviolent, actually. He says, why don't we just go up to him and ask him why he's doing it? I don't even have a gun on me. And I'm like, that's the first thing I said, is like, what if you ask him that and he has a gun and he fucking pops both of us right there? And he just looked at me and goes, I don't think he's going to do that. So we did that. I don't know why I went with him. So we did that. And the guy goes, well, my name is Jerry, blah, 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 just for the tape. It doesn't matter who he is. And he goes, I'm a promoter, and I have sort of at the arena. And they're all up there, and I've never seen something so sophisticated in my life. And I'm in arenas around, who are you guys? And so we said that, and he checked out. And so he asked us at the end of the night, he goes, do you think you guys could do this in bigger places? And we said, I guess so. So long story short, he gave us this break that we ended up bodyguarding entertainers around the country. And creating that same system in different places. And we became very successful at it, except financially. But we look great from the outside and got a lot of press and a lot of things. And fundamentally, one of the issues was I was getting very sick and I was getting uncontrollable in my extravagance, which is I was starting to think I was one of them and had the pocketbook of them instead of the one next to them getting paid as the hired help. So I was blowing through so much dough, I was wrecking the place, the business. So I came up with a great idea at that time, because he had been in the special forces and all that. I said, I wonder how good I could really be. I'm going to go, we'll get rid of this thing. It's not going to work anyway. We'll look good when we leave, and I'll go into the Army and go into special forces. Man, powerless over my thinking, you know, just horrible idea. So I did that, sold it, we all look good, and went to basic AAT, and immediately, because I'm just, you know, I got a lot of talent, they put me right into Ranger School. You know, they were like, this cat can take a lot of pain. And that was true. I was so numb, you could just put me through anything for as many days as you want. And at the end of it, I'm like, got anything else? And they just were like, he's a perfect warrior. Just perfect. And now I'm really sick. In the middle of that, I get a girl pregnant. I decide to do the right thing. I elope and I marry her. You ought to see my mother's face on that day coming home. But I was trying to do the right thing because I never did the right thing, you know. I'm, you know, 9 months sober. I'm insane. My sponsor is just screaming at, now literally physically screaming at me, like, wake up. I just remember him all red. Wake up. He's pleading for me not to destroy my life more. I just couldn't hear it or was afraid or whatever I was. So I ran into that, and then the same thing happened, you know, is we were here on the West Coast, and there, you know, I won't go into the whole story, but I got popped for with a bunch of guys, all in special forces for entrepreneurial thought of trafficking. And man, you know, I knew I shouldn't be involved in all that, but I was afraid of being the odd guy out, because it was all of us or none of us. And I just did not have the courage to say no. I'm like, I'm enlisted. This is my team. I have nowhere to go, and I can never say this story. So I said yes, and we got popped. And we went to Leavenworth Penitentiary for that. And I was scared because we got a deal cut because it was attached to a black op plane, and they didn't want that out. And when I was taking time, one of those planes in South America got shot down, and the whole Iran-Contra thing blew up. And we were on one of those black. We were doing the security for it, so we just asked on the other end, could they put more of the product in, and we would cut it up and sell it in California. That was our thing. Bam. So here's me, classic fearful Rick. I get off that bus into Leavenworth, see the very first guard, and shackled, I just fucking beat him to a pulp, too. Just really did. And they beat me to a pulp and put me into solitary. Just broke me. I mean, I got a beating that was going to take quite a few months to heal from. But I was so scared, and I wanted to make a reputation again that no one would hurt me. I was just so scared of being raped, or that's what I did. So here's kind of what happened in there. I'm sitting in solitary, you know. I can hardly see because I'm so puffed up and broken. I have this thought, a moment of clarity again, which was, I don't think people with 4 years sober end up here. Wow. I just knew, like, I'm in deep trouble. So, maybe a few days after that, week, maybe it's hard to tell when you're 23 hours, 1 hour out. You don't really know time. My meal comes, and under my meal is a big book, which is contraband. And it came in. Well, no one knows me because I got off the thing, did my thing, and I'm in solitary. I haven't met anybody. And I got a big book. And that's what I said last night about the long arm of AA has reached into some very dark holes and pulled me out. That's a long, dark hole. And I got pulled out of that. And that's when, that's where it really got born in me, the power of silence and thinking. Because I was alone with myself, with my thinking. I could not escape myself. And I had nowhere to go. And so I had an intuitive thought that I could just use this silence like a monk would, which I didn't know what that really meant. And I would just observe my thinking and not run from any thought like my life depended on it. And that's what I started doing there, just hours at a time, because I couldn't go anywhere. And little did I know that would be the bedrock of my spiritual life this whole time. Out of the ashes came a discipline, because I had nowhere to go. That would change my whole life. So I get out of there. 3-4 months later, after I healed enough that I was passable. And I meet this guy. He sees me, introduces himself to me, and I asked him, I said, are you the guy who gave me the big book? He was the thing. And he said, yeah. I said, well, how did you even know? And he says, well, we have AA here. And all of us are pretty trustworthy, so we have some of us work in the front office, and your jacket came in, and you said you were 4 years sober, which I did from before I got there. And the office told me that. So he said, our job's to help alcoholics. So I got a big book and I smuggled it into you so you'd have a lifeline. And I said, man, why'd you do that? You would end up in where I was. He says, one, I'm in here for life. And two, he goes, I'm already free. He goes, I would welcome your spot, less to do. He became my sponsor in there. And he's the one that heard my inventory. And I told him that thing. And I really got free in there. And then I came out. And I did contrary behavior as much as I could. But I kind of stayed in that silent groove, like meditate as much as I could. So, because I knew my thinking was so warped that if I didn't stay on that, I could ruin my life again, because I did. And I knew I was powerless over my thinking without a doubt. And I knew from the time I got sober what I wanted to do, and it was to help other alcoholics. And I'm like, now I'm a convicted felon. I have a high school education. I don't know what to do. I'm done. I have a buddy in AA. When I go to there, he knows I just came out of prison because my back's against the wall. He's been out of prison for 4 years. He comes up to me. He's like 22. And he says, you just get out? I said, yeah. It's pretty easy to see, you know. And he was a counselor for at the teenage clinic for alcoholics at the hospital. So maybe 6 months later, like, I'm unemployable. I mean, who's going to take me to do anything? And I'm not going back. So here's what happened was, and I had all this shame that I went to prison sober. I mean, I don't have a good story of success. And I had a lot of shame on that. And I, you know, so he came to me one day. He goes, look, I got another job at the other hospital. Why don't you apply? And I said, I can't apply. I mean, why? What story do I have? He says, just apply. Just, you come up. I want you to talk to the head of the adolescent unit. So I went, just contrary behavior. I said, I don't have any. That's when I started learning I don't have anything to lose. I can always go back to what I wanted. That's when that happened. So I go up. I tell her my story. I'm rigorously honest, so she doesn't think, like, if one of these kids want to talk to me, then I'm really that good of a model. I get done, and she goes, Mike was his name. He says, Mike told me you'd be the perfect person for this job. I'm going to give you the job. I said, what's the job? He says, we have a portion of this adolescent unit is for adolescents who are going to go do prison time. And you're going to be their counselor, and you're going to show them how to stay sober in prison. So all of that birthed a whole new life for me. And that, you can't even dream it up. So it's hard to kind of say, like, something doesn't exist. And it really, that job changed my life. I went back to school and got my bachelor's in psych, went, kept going, got my master's in social work. I found out I was actually really smart, and I just did all that. And I got into the men's movement and rubbed-a-dubbed and, you know, just got into it, and I was on fire. That's when I got nauseating about big book thumping, man. I was preaching to the choir, and you were my hostages. And I was, like, lit up. And, you know, hey, it's where I was, and it was great. And I made mistakes during there like we all do as we get sober. But my whole life started changing radically. And I was really getting free, and it was really beautiful. And then January 10th, 1990, my son was born. I had a spiritual experience in the delivery room. And I thought it was just a heat. You know, a heat came through me. It was really strong. I was like, wow, that's... It almost like bowled me over when I touched him. He literally came out of his mom and handed him to me. And I got jolted by... Not jolted, but I just felt this heat. And it was just, wow. And a vision came to me. I'm not going to say what the vision was, but it was powerful vision about his life. And I put him under the heat lamp. And, you know... Next day, I went back to work to the therapy office, and something wild happened. I went, you know, you write reports because we didn't have really computers, you know. So I went to get the pen, and when I reached for the pen moved away from me, like chi hit it. And I was like, let me try that again. And it moved again, and I was kind of like, wow. And then all of a sudden, I wasn't sleeping, like, and all these things started happening to me, and I had no reference for it, and I can't go into all of it. And, you know, hindsight, I was in a spiritual experience, and I didn't know it. And I'm a therapist, and I'm psychologically trained, not spiritually trained, and I'm really thinking I'm going crazy. But I started noticing things like, I have some really sick clients, you know, like clinically ill, like mentally ill, like their psychosis is all over the place. And one came to me, and they came the next week, and all of a sudden there's no psychosis in her, like nothing. And I'm like, "What? Where'd you go?" And she goes, "Nowhere. What are you talking about?" And she's totally lucid. And I started seeing other people, and they were the same way. And I was like, man, what's going on here? So a person who worked for me said, you should go talk to this lady and in D.C. on the phone because I think you're having this thing. She didn't tell me what it was. but I think she could help you. So I called her, and she just said, you're having a spiritual experience, and this energy that's coming through you is, we think, it's like, she explained it because my background, she goes, you know how, like, when you take martial arts, you channel your energy and you break a brick. I'm like, I get that. So same thing, but it's full of love. And so she instructed me, which scared me, but I did it, to start putting my hands over people and see if they would change. So I started doing that. And long story short, that incident moved me out of AA, which is why a lot of people who struggle with being in AA, I really dug some very deep holes in other spiritual traditions, because AA did not have the answers for what was really going on with me. And I just really went that way, and I deepened enormously in it. And that's what I mean, I'm not in AA. I'll show up to a meeting here and there, and everybody's loving me, and I'm really like a new guy. And so that's how that was. And I learned a lot, and I became arrogant about AA, like AA's for losers. Kindergarten, you ever hear that? So if you feel like that, I'm with you. So that's that question, you ever feel like AA's not worth. So I was like that, and I made everybody wrong. They just talk about their past. I'm about the present. Spiritual bypass. Spiritual bypass in all its glory. So I meet Lisa, who's now my wife. I've done a lot of work with my sex addiction, all this stuff, remember? So that's that piece. And I'm really, my life's good. And I'm doing this thing, and here's the most beautiful thing about it, is I remember one day I was in London working. I remember looking down, and I was like, wow, these same hands that used to just rage and hurt so many human beings are totally the opposite. They're totally dedicated to love and healing. And I felt complete with that past. Like I forgave myself. And I just changed. My heart opened finally. And I just started crying like a baby. It was just so beautiful, you know. I was thinking, oh my God, if I cry too much on this guy, he's like he's gonna notice, like he's gonna, like I pissed on him or something. And I'm really, he's getting really wet, like his, you know, you know how you have those moments when it's really heavy, you're like, oh my God, he's gonna think I did something to him. It's really puddling. So I did that, and the rest doesn't matter. Except this. Lisa, meeting her, she was steeped in AA, 35 years sober, and every time I would meet her, she'd always be with her sponsor, and she always was at a big book meeting, and Joe and Charlie, and she'd been doing that from the day she got sober, and she had quite a few years, and she was really, she startled me. She was as spiritually fit in her behavior as anybody I met in any other room in another path. And it surprised me, because I didn't think that was possible here. She was totally lit up and grounded and smooth. People who know her, wouldn't you agree? She's still that way. It's amazing. And it piqued my interest about AA. So anyway, a long story short, she got transferred. She was going between New York and LA, and our relationship got to the point we thought we should be in the same city, and I was in San Francisco because of San Francisco Zen Center and driving. So I was deepening my personal path. So I said, we decided to move in together. Well, we didn't really decide that. I was allowed to stay at her house for 30 days and then get my own place. Because she was very clear, I don't actually live with men. I only live with a man who's committed. So you would have to, we'd have to be engaged, basically. And there was no pressure. She was just telling me a fact. She was working her program. I don't do that anymore in my life. So I got in there, but before I went, her sponsor said, when you get there, I want you to go and find this guy, Clint H., and have him take you through the steps. So I came, went to a meeting, didn't like it, none of that's important. A guy there said, I know where Clint is. He goes to this West LA men's stag thing the next night. He goes, I'll meet you there. I go to this meeting, 95. I meet Clint, and I notice in these rooms, Radcliffe, I mean, there were a lot of people there that was in this room that were in there that meeting. And this guy introduced me to Clint, and what was great about that story is I never saw that guy again. Nowhere. Never in that meeting, no other, never saw him. It almost makes you think, did he exist? Or knew Lisa from New York, loved her, said, I'll take Rick. Wow. So I meet Clint, tell him this story and what I'm doing, and I'm got to leave because that's what I do. And he's very interested in the experiential thing of what I went through. It piqued his interest. But what I noticed in the room was there were like four guys that felt like Lisa. So smooth. And it startled me. I was like, wow, this does exist? And then I was like, wow. And I was super steep in the Buddhist path. And a thought came to me. It's like, this gave me my spiritual path. Maybe this is in that tradition. You might be studying somewhere else, but you would say where you got lit up, they call it your root path or your root guru, like where you came from. So they'll say, well, my root's this and I'm doing this. And I thought, well, maybe this could be my root lineage, because AA put me on the path. So Clint does what we all do. I say, hey, Peggy told me to do this, take me through the steps. And he just said yes. Get a book, brand new book, read, same thing we all go through, 164, boom. Here's what I find out. Everything I learned that was valuable in my path outside of AA was in the 12 steps. They were literally the action steps of every mystical tradition I had been practicing and got so much from. Without all the other stuff, so it was the most powerful combination of right livelihood. You know what we talked about? That ethical code to be able to do it. It had it all in here, and I noticed it, and I had one of those moments like, I spent all that time outside of here, and it was all in front of me from the beginning. I remember that moment clear. Wow. It was so beautiful. And Clint took people at his office Saturday and Sunday. Luther was 10 o'clock in the morning, I was 11, Luther would wait for Clint, they'd go to lunch, and then after a few months, they invited me to lunch. I was scared, because they all were in their 20s, you know, and I'm mid-teens, 15 years sober, and I'm like, oh my God, what do like real spiritual people talk about? Where, but we went. Yeah, I don't even remember what they talked about, but I was glad to be a part of the fellowship. So that's what happened with Clinton and I. And then I opened my world up to Clint, and he opened this world up in very specific detail for me. And then we started interweaving techniques. And then he gave me that thing around the 11th step because I had so much hodgepodge of styles. He's like, you got to get disciplined, and the 11th step will God disciplines you in that way, and that's why I did it so long formally. And it integrated all these styles. And I got so free. And then I was doing those amends that we talked about, and I decided to do that. And I had a power in me I never had to go make every single amend. I made every single amend eyeball to eyeball like we do in this group. It took me 5 years. I flew everywhere, and I stayed eyeball to eyeball, and I would not take, unless they didn't want to see me, which of course I had a few, you know, but, you know, people say, well, you could do it on the phone. I said, no, I'll come to you. And anytime I had an amend to make, somehow the money would come for me to be there, and I had no money. But every time I got there, it was a miracle. A miracle. And then all of a sudden I had a problem. Lisa and I were going to get married, and I told that story, and I was kind of at the end. I had this one and one more. Both of them were the two worst ones. And for the first time in my life, I was afraid to go do the amend because I had so much to lose. And then really up to that point, even in sobriety, it was just me, and I felt like I had nothing to lose. But I just loved her so much, I was like, God. I was so conflicted. And I didn't have to do them because it's kind of, you know, it would meet criteria normally. And I didn't have enough faith. And in that moment, that same woman who was so bright that brought me back said, had more faith than me and said, go do it. The point's not to come back. The point's to do it. We're not in the results business. We're in the action business. My whole life changed out of that moment. I'm not in the results business. I'm in the action business. So the rest of it you pretty much know. We've been having a lot of fun here. And when the healing practice grew, my counseling practice went into a coaching practice. So I started coaching people because I was on the road, and they did it by the phone, and I was licensed, but I couldn't be licensed doing what I was doing, so I gave that up, and I became a coach. Then that part of the things became really successful for me. So through the years, I would just travel, and then I coach and heal, and then the coaching business grew, and then that same little voice said, stop healing. You know, you'd have a bigger impact with executives, coaching them and having them, you know, change their decision-making, and that's what I did. I didn't mean to do it, or I just wanted a vehicle to talk to people who were suffering. I've been really successful at it. And one day when that happened, I got a vision that one day when I was older, I'd probably go back to a contemplative life. So I was like, so I obeyed, freaked everybody up around me. It impacted my wife the most. Because she married a guy that basically stayed in a room all day, channeling something greater than him. So when you come out of that, you're a pretty cool guy. Because you don't have any mind left. But when I changed and I was in thinking more, I wasn't the same guy. I had more character defects. I was a different man. And we talked about that. And she said, it's just part of that commitment to grow spiritually together in coupleship. I don't know if I could say that to somebody. I would probably left them. It's like, well, you were one way, now you're another way. I'm out of here. I would have, I think. Too big of a difference. She did not do that. The power of living with someone, living this way of life. And then you heard the story with Clint, you know, after all those years. I'm really way over. Are you still raptured or you want to leave? All right, I'll try to wrap it up. I'm sorry. I'll tell you a funny story about Clint. Luther, I think, knows the story. I became very successful in the coaching thing. So I wanted to show Clint how many people he really had affected. Because he changed me and I was a vehicle. So I was in Washington, D.C., and I was doing stuff with Congress, senators, and House of Representatives, and I was going to facilitate an offsite. So there's once you have so many senators and House of Representatives, you have to hold the meeting at this, I don't know how many places they got, but in Virginia, behind all these bushes, the bushes drop down, there's a hotel in there with all cleared field, and then they have all this security, so that's where the meeting was. So I brought Clint, because they were making decisions that were, it was a decision, they were trying to negotiate behind the scenes, a decision that really would affect the country, and I was going to work that day, work that. And I wanted him to just see, like, one drunk helping another, where it came, because he had never gone out with me. So the funniest thing happened. So I go in there, and we're sitting in the pre-thing, and, they're all coming in. And someone goes, who's he? And he's way older than me. So I can't say who he really is, because I'm anonymous. I say this, I didn't think about it. I said, he's my mentor. Well, I'm mentoring them. So they all leave me and start asking him questions. He starts giving them advice. Like he's a coach. But he was giving they would ask a question, he'd go in, get an intuitive thought, and he'd say something like he would say to us, like AA advice. And you guys see him, that's awesome. because it all was like coming together and compromising. And he was just like, well, sometimes you just got to give up your opinion. They're just opinions. Doesn't mean you're right. Well, he said that to this one cat who was the worst thing we had. So I go facilitate, we leave for the next day. So that we do that, and I start working the next day. So Clint, when we get back into the guy, we had to go in a secure car. We get into that, and he, how he does, he slaps you on the leg. So we're sitting in there, and he slaps me on the leg, and he goes, one drunk helping another. Oh my God, I had no idea, and he started crying. And I started crying. And the Secret Service guy in the front's going, what the hell's going on? He's not saying anything. He's highly trained. But he's just thinking, here's this 67-year-old and 50-something. They're starting to convulse a little. They're crying so hard because it was like, you showed me God, good orderly direction. And really all that's going on is we're trying to show good orderly direction. It was just, I was so happy for that because he got sick right after it and died. But he got to see how many people he influenced. And you influence people like that, but we don't see it. You know what I mean? All the people you've influence people. And the watershed is hundreds of thousands of people we influence. But we don't know it. We're just trying to not suffer one day at a time, right? But we influence. And he saw that. And then I already told you the story of the day he died. And then, I had my thing, which I'm going to work and heal, about just not speaking. And I just have lived that same life with my wife and sponsees and doing the next right thing ever since then to this day. And it's been really beautiful. And I think the only thing I'll say when I got my little news that if I deteriorate at the same level, I'll be dead within a year. I externally did not have to change one thing in my life, and neither did my wife. Not one thing. And I told Luther, thank God for being in a group of men who just do work, who give me enough courage to keep going. It was such a good feeling. I almost felt like, I guess that was the moment, way deep down in my soul. It was like, good job, Ricky. That's what I was called when I was little, Ricky. And I just remember in my mind, or God, saying, good job, Ricky. And I felt like I came home just this year, full circle, all the way down to the root. I came home 38 years sober. It was just that moment that we talk about, the whole experience, it just all opened up. So, we did what we did, and in the middle of that, Dale called me. He said, it's the 25th anniversary of the West LA Men's Stag Retreat. Would you come? Be the retreat master. And I told you about him dying a good death. And I hadn't gotten my news yet, and, you know, I felt horrible. And I just said, you know what? It's time to come home. You know, and if I die, I'll die from home. You know, where I learned it all and put it all together, or it got put together for me, like all of it came together and seamless. So I said yes. Then he handed me off to Pacey. And then Pacey just, you know, we did this thing. And in the meantime, Luther and Bruce and... And then that really was it in the program. Kind of helped me and would ask me things and be direct. And then later on, my test came back better. So I guess it, you know, what's the great thing about a good physical death, being a spiritual being having a human experience, it's all those deaths in ego, easing God out. And for some reason, just this year, it came together for me. And I flawed, as you can see, I demonstrated every section. I am flawed. Doesn't mean I'm not flawed. But I'm grateful to the men who sat with me every Thursday night for many years doing it together. For AA, for being here from the beginning to the end and being so patient. And for men, as I road got narrower and I needed more specific direction, people with depth and weight who have practiced before me and knew the answers specifically told me those for me to apply. So, when we introduced ourselves last night, in normal tradition, you know, the retreat master's last. But in AA tradition, about you're only as good as the shoulders you stand on, my sponsor was last, who stood on his sponsor's shoulders. So, Luther, I'm glad that wherever I've traveled in my inner life, you have been there, and you can, in a very detailed way, show me how to keep going. And I'm very happy that I actually kind of understand you verbally. Man, a lot of pain. Just like that guy, he's 38 years sober and dumb as a rock right at the moment. You know, you just have that, like, he ain't getting it at all. Patience, tolerance, love is our code. So with that, we will have dinner at 6, meeting at 7, and I love you.